This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Developments in Washington have been coming at a breakneck pace in recent weeks, from the firing of FBI Director James Comey to the changing explanations for it. Then there were the allegations that President Trump shared classified intelligence with Russian diplomats, and there was the appointment of a Justice Department special counsel to continue the probe into Russian influence in U.S. electoral politics.
The way it has been going, there may have been new developments just since the start of this sentence. Art Sear joins us every month to try to make sense of developments on the foreign policy front. Art, there are a lot of people who compare the current situation in the White House to the Watergate scandal and Richard Nixon. How do you see that as a good comparison, and where does it start to break down?
I think it's a good comparison in the sense that there are allegations of serious criminal wrongdoing that go right to the top in the White House. Also, Watergate is a turning point. What was generally acceptable in American politics, even at the national level before then, especially at the national level, has changed significantly since. And in that sense, as in many other policy areas, I think Richard Nixon was significant. Where it breaks down is even more than pre-Watergate, even more than during the Watergate period. I think there is an unholy alliance, as I've said on your program before and gotten away with it, between the media across the board and Donald Trump, who is essentially a media figure in terms of getting to the top more than any other president. And he feeds the news cycle in a way that is very profitable for everyone. So far, we have no smoking gun, as the Watergate types used to say. We have all kinds of speculation and blue sky discussion of what might be true, even on NPR and the BBC, which I respect a lot. In that sense, we don't have anything yet, so we'll see.
It seems like what you're saying here is that the president is addicted to the media and the media is addicted to the president.
Right, our first tweeting president. Yeah, so it becomes self-reinforcing and a lot of other news is driven out. I was listening this morning as I was driving up to public radio and a Texas Republican congressman who will not be named said that he has 5 televisions in his office.
I heard that metaphor interview as well.
Right. That's disturbing, but also representative of our time. Lyndon Johnson was ahead of his time. He had 3 TVs in the Oval Office and was frenetic and frantic as his problems mounted about watching them relentlessly. It's a symbol of our times, and it's a symbol of how the media can kind of drive not only events but hysteria.
Well, and so one of the interesting things that this very same Texas congressman pointed out or made the case for is that there are a lot of either unsourced or anonymous allegations that are part of this story. But, you know, as someone who has studied this, studied various periods in history and the presidency, what are the concrete things that have happened in the Trump administration in even just the last couple of weeks that really get your notice that we ought to be paying attention to?
Well, what one real event that is central and rightly as a focus is the firing of FBI Director James Comey that I believe was a serious blunder on the part of the president and not the way a more experienced politician would have operated. That's a major event, and closely related to that, the appointment of Robert Mueller, a close friend as well as associate of Comey's, to be the special prosecutor, the special counsel in this case, indicates how serious matters are and is a really bad sign for the president.
Well, right. And so the appointment of Robert Mueller in this case was a moment of maybe rare bipartisanship in the last few months in Washington, in the sense that both Republicans and Democrats seem to welcome this announcement.
Yeah. From the beginning, the president of his remarkably successful presidential run, the president has been an isolated figure because of his style, personality, and approach to things. There are a lot of Republicans, I believe, as well as Democrats in Washington, not just in Congress, who'd like to get rid of this guy. And if he gets in trouble, serious legal trouble, which he is not now, despite all the hyperbole, I do believe he'll go down rather quickly. And in that sense, the real analogy isn't so much Richard Nixon, who I believe was a significant and certainly durable leader, especially in policy terms, but Joseph McCarthy, who dominated American politics in an eerie and very destructive way during the height of the anti-communist hysteria in the late 40s and well into the 50s, and went down very quickly once he got in trouble, destroyed by Dwight Eisenhower. We know now, people didn't know then. Behind the scenes, lots of things are going on at any time in politics, and that's important to keep in mind at this time of great tension and media frenzy.
You described the firing of FBI Director James Comey as a blunder, not necessarily an illegal blunder, though.
No. The president also dealing with the Russians is not in any way necessarily breaking the law. Article 2 of the Constitution makes the president commander-in-chief, and he or she has tremendous independent authority to do what they wish, including sending force overseas. It's been a controversial subject since the Jefferson administration, at least, our third president. But the president has a lot of independent authority, and we should keep that in mind.
Well, and along those lines, there was the story that came out that's almost been forgotten in the last few days about what the president chose to share with Russian diplomats when they visited the Oval Office. And as you say, the president has a lot of discretion in these areas. At the same time, that does not necessarily make it any easier on our intelligence forces or our diplomatic forces around the globe.
No, and I think one byproduct of this probably already is that especially our closest allies are going to be more reluctant to share information. And just as the professionals in the FBI have a lot of motivation to do their job even better than before, I'm quite confident our intelligence professionals in the military, the NSA, and elsewhere, as well as the CIA, are going to be redoubling their efforts to be effective. But with the British, the so-called Five Eyes, the British, Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, and us, since World War II, we've been especially close. That's going to be challenged. And, of course, our special relationship with Israel is challenged by this, I believe, misstep by the chief executive.
Well, what happens to the relationship between our intelligence agencies and the executive office?
I think
if it exists.
I think there is distance there as well. I'm a great admirer of H.R. McMaster. He's what we used to call a dedicated public servant, a dedicated officer, very effective in combat in the first Gulf War. He's written a brilliant book, A Prosecutor's Case, in hindsight, of course, but a brilliant book analyzing the Vietnam War and the errors of President Johnson and Defense Secretary McNamara. He's put himself out front on this. The president should feel very lucky that he has him. I'm not sure he does. And he and others in this administration, I think, are impressive people, and their role in protecting the office as well as the person will become even more important, I believe, as this unfolds.
When it comes to collecting intelligence, can the NSA or the CIA effectively cut out the executive office when it comes to a lot of what they do?
Ultimately, no. It's one reason I mentioned Article 2 of the Constitution. But in point of fact, we do have mechanisms for removing a president. There is impeachment and conviction. It's happened twice with unfortunate President Andrew Johnson right after the Civil War, who almost was removed, and while Bill Clinton, who through his own vices got himself in trouble. It's not used much, but it's there to use. Also, the 25th Amendment, I think it is, after President Kennedy's assassination, one positive consequence of that horrible time is an amendment was passed, I think, in 65. It was ratified about a year and a half after Dallas. And that provides a mechanism whereby a majority of the cabinet, plus the vice president, if they agree that the president is incapacitated or missing in action, they can, in effect, declare him out of office temporarily. And then ultimately, Congress has to ratify that. So if, speaking hypothetically, the president were to go berserk completely, there is a mechanism there to remove him. Our system does work. It's one reason we can afford a media that's not terribly responsible these days. I don't put you in that category.
I appreciate that.
Sure, I want to be invited back, but no, you're not. I'm glad the BBC is expanding their, but we can afford a lot in this country in terms of irresponsibility because we have the law.
Well, and some people have pointed to the distinction between criminal offense and impeachable offense and made the point that in recent years, when impeachment has been pursued, it has been for things like the violation of the terms of the oath of office.
Yes. Well, high crimes and misdemeanors is purposely ambiguous. Our Constitution is remarkably brief.
You know, the phenomenon in the middle of all this that some have pointed to that's interesting is what seems to be a swapping of roles. The Republican Party in this country has historically been the party that has been staunchly anti-Russia. But here we are with a Republican president whose campaign is accused, and again, these are just accusations, but accused of having ties to Russian officials, who welcomes Russian diplomats to the Oval Office, who shares classified intelligence with them and apparently admits to that. What's happened here? Is this, I mean, are we talking about Donald Trump specifically now, or are we talking about a sea change in Republican attitudes towards what, you know, some used to refer to as the evil empire?
I think you're President Reagan, I think, and candidate Reagan especially. I think you're referring to Donald Trump, the person. He's not a typical Republican. He's an outsider who came up very quickly, brilliantly, in terms of electoral politics. But he does not represent past or present Republican conservatism. That's a very good point. I'm going to have to think more about that.
And finally, you know, what's interesting, another thing that a lot of this is interesting, but one of the interesting other phenomena that has surfaced in recent days is, you know, the fact that President Trump still polls fairly strongly among his Republican base, the people who put him into office.
Yeah.
Is there a difference between what the current political climate means to the Trump presidency and what it means to Republicans who potentially face re-election in, you know, a year and a half?
Yes, it is different. He didn't have any particularly important coattails compared to other presidential winners in terms of helping the Republicans in Congress. He is a very independent kind of standalone leader, more than previous presidents, perhaps more than any previous president. The personal support, his friendliness with the Russians doesn't help him. However, the polls seem remarkably steady. He's a little under 40% in terms of approval. He's notably over 50% in terms of disapproval. Those numbers haven't changed. If he gets in serious legal trouble, they may. But keep in mind, there are very large numbers, millions of our fellow Americans who don't trust the media, don't trust polls, don't answer polls, don't answer the phone. If they don't, you know, he's brought out a huge mass of Americans whose votes count and they should count, who are quite alienated, not just from Washington, but from the media and our system overall. Very important phenomenon.
And apparently people for whom it takes more than the current situation in Washington to alienate them from Donald Trump.
Exactly. No, whatever happens, I think for many of these individuals, it's the conspiracy. It's them. They who take advantage of us in life, at work, they are taking advantage of our leader. I think his support goes up in certain circles. Karl Marx, whom I like to mention because he's out of vogue with the collapse of communism most places, he wrote brilliantly about class conflict. We've fortunately avoided a communist revolution. He also wrote about alienation. I hate my work, and therefore my life is I'm having trouble making a living. In a fundamental human sense, Marx was quite right, and we should pay attention to that dimension, alienation. Anybody who gets elected to office at some point has to pay attention to that dimension.
All right. So in 2017, then, to get back to Marx, what is the opiate of the masses?
Well, I think a highly emotional appeal that goes beyond policy in the case of Donald Trump. People are sick of the system. The tremendous growing disparity since about 1970 in incomes, in the concentration of tremendous wealth at the top, which Marx did predict, the return to a kind of gilded age similar to the 1890s through the 1920s, I think that is a big part of the political dynamic.
That, and you could probably say cable news is the opiate of the masses.
Well, the media generally, yes. The fact that we used to have three networks, government regulated, and we don't anymore, that's a plus and a minus. We have far more information, but far more freedom to promote misinformation and indulge ourselves. You're quite right. I'll have to think more about that too, Mr. Tyke.
Fortunately, not much misinformation here in the last few minutes. Art Sear, thanks.
I hope not. Thank you very much, Mitch.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's also a regular guest on Lake Effect.